From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, President Trump announces that he's pulling the U.S. out of the Iran nuclear deal.
The Iran deal is defective at its core. If we do nothing, we know exactly what will happen.
Also today, New York Attorney General Eric Schneiderman resigns amid deeply disturbing allegations that he slapped and choked women. We'll get analysis on that, and Rudy Giuliani's getting his facts straight about Stormy Daniels, all with our legal analyst. And Massachusetts billionaire Bill Cummings. He started with a humble fruit punch business and grew it to 11 million square feet of real estate. Now he's trying to change philanthropy.
What we're working toward is this new kind of foundation in the end that is really a community foundation right down to the actual giving.
That's all coming up next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
In just a short period of time, the world's leading state sponsor of terror will be on the cusp of acquiring the world's most dangerous weapons. Therefore, I am announcing today that the United States will withdraw from the Iran nuclear deal.
That was President Donald Trump a little earlier today saying that, yes, the U.S. is leaving the Iran nuclear deal. President Trump also signed a memorandum reinstating sanctions on Iran.
We will be instituting the highest level of economic sanction. Any nation that helps Iran in its quest for nuclear weapons could also be strongly sanctioned by the United States. America will not be held hostage to nuclear blackmail.
Well, let's get some reaction from Gary Seymour. He's executive director for research at the Belfer Center for Science and International Affairs at the Harvard Kennedy School of Government. He's also former White House coordinator for arms control and weapons of mass destruction, proliferation, and terrorism in the first Obama administration. He joins us today from Tel Aviv. Gary Seymour, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
Also with us is Max Abrams, assistant professor of political science at Northeastern University. Max Abrams, it's good to have you back as well.
Happy to be here.
So I first want to just get your initial reaction from both of you, if I could. Gary, let's just start with you. Does the U.S. pulling out of the Iran nuclear deal essentially scuttle the whole thing?
Not right away. I think the Iranians will be quite cautious in their reaction. And as a first step, they will appeal to the joint commission that's created by the nuclear agreement that the U.S. is violating the agreement, which, of course, we are. The Iranians will look for some commitment from the other parties, the Europeans, Russia, and China, to continue to keep the deal in place, in which case Iran will say it's willing to continue to honor the nuclear constraints. Whether that's sustainable over time, however, I think is questionable because U.S. secondary sanctions will begin to limit the benefits Iran gets from the agreement.
I see. So, Max Abrams, though, I'm seeing here that the Associated Press is tweeting just now that Iran's president says if negotiations fail, the Islamic Republic will enrich uranium, quote, more than before in the next weeks.
Yeah, I don't think this is going to be pretty at all. I do think that the Iranian leadership, at least initially, is going to try to keep this thing afloat. You know, this isn't just a bilateral agreement between the U.S. and Iran. There are other parties, too. There's China, Russia, France, the U.K., Germany. And so I think that Iran is going to see, you know, does this have legs? Does the deal have legs, even in the absence of the U.S. As, you know, a participant? But in the long term, I don't think that that's probably sustainable. I expected Trump to say that he wanted out of the nuclear agreement. I expected that. But what I was paying attention to were the sanctions.
Mm-hmm.
Were they going to be, you know, mild sanctions? Were they going to start right away? And it's not entirely clear based on what he said, but it did sound as if the sanctions would be quite severe. And he even talked about, you know, penalizing other countries that, you know, are in violation. And so I'm pessimistic about where this goes. And I think that this is the beginning of the end of the nuclear deal, if I were to make a prediction.
Okay. Gary Seymour, I'm curious about what you think. In many ways, it seems that we reached a point of inevitability, right? The way the president has been talking for a long time about his view of the Iran deal. But in recent days and weeks, we had a visit from Emmanuel Macron and Angela Merkel, in part to try and save the Iran deal or to keep the U.S. in it. But then on the other hand, we had Benjamin Netanyahu giving this PowerPoint presentation is essentially saying that Israel had evidence that of Iran's nuclear activity. So was that the thing that finally cleared the way for Trump to make this announcement?
I think Trump has believed for a long time that he can break the deal, he can bring greater pressure to bear on Iran and force them to negotiate a better agreement that corrects what he sees as the flaws in the current agreement. I think Trump is mistaken. I do not think he will be able to put together the same kind of economic pressure that forced Iran to make concessions in the original agreement, at least not in the remaining years of his first term. So I think Trump's calculation is incorrect, but I believe he thinks, as he sees himself as a master negotiator, he can force the Iranians back to the table to make more concessions.
I mean, does that seem like a likelihood, Max Abrams? Let me just play a little bit of tape here, right? This is from Iranian President Hassan Rouhani. He just spoke in Tehran through a translator. Here's what he said.
Iran is a country that adheres to its commitments, and the U.S. is a country that has never adhered to its commitments.
I mean, so we're in the first moments after President Trump's announcement, but that doesn't sound like an Iranian president who's willing to come back to the table.
Yeah, I thought that there would be more of an emphasis of that in the speech, where basically Trump would say something like, you know, the nuclear deal isn't dead, we'll stay in it, conditional on, you know, certain, you know, expectations and changes being met. But that's not really what I heard. Trump said, listen, if I were you, I wouldn't accept, you know, revisions to the deal either. And he didn't actually propose any sort of middle ground for Iran realistically to make the changes. I mean, what Trump did is he enumerated the well-known problems with the deal. For example, the so-called sunset provisions, where the enforcement degrades over time after 10, 15 years. There have been complaints over the inspection provisions, that they don't include all military installations. The nuclear deal doesn't cover missiles, and of course doesn't do anything to thwart Iran from supporting terrorist groups. But we've already known that those were sort of limitations or not addressed at all by the nuclear deal. I view the U.S. unequivocally now as walking away, and I do not see Iran responding by making any new concessions.
Gary Seymour, what do you think?
I agree with that. I think Trump's decision to withdraw from the agreement is stupid because it won't achieve the objective he is seeking. It's not going to produce a better deal. If anything, it will be the death of this deal and Iran gradually reviving its nuclear program. I think the Iranians will be very cautious about how they revive their nuclear program because they don't want to give Trump a pretext for bombing them.
Can I just ask you about that? Because I just want to cut to the chase because I know some people are definitely wondering this. I mean, is this a prelude to putting the U.S., Israel, who knows, in the region on a war footing with Iran?
So, of course, it's hard to know what's in people's minds. I believe that Prime Minister Netanyahu would like to see the U.S. attack Iran, and I believe he thinks that the collapse of the nuclear deal may create conditions for that to happen. I don't think Trump is spoiling for a war with Iran. I think Trump genuinely believes that he can force Iran to accept a better deal. As I said, I think that's a mistaken belief, but I think he's motivated by what he sees as his ability to shake things up and bring pressure to bear and produce a better agreement.
Gary Samar, I mean, just to remind folks, you're in Tel Aviv today. You're speaking to us from Israel. I don't know if you've had a chance to talk to people there. I mean, what's the initial reaction to the fact that the president did indeed pull the U.S. out of the deal?
Well, what's remarkable is that the Israeli defense and security establishment, that is to say, people who are officers in the intelligence and defense organizations here in Israel, they think the deal is working. It's flawed in many ways, but for now, the deal is performing as it was designed to do, to constrain Iran's nuclear program, and they think it's a mistake for the U.S. to withdraw. Of course, the prime minister has a very different view, but the professionals would prefer to see the deal in place and focus attention on other elements of Iran's behavior, like its activities in Syria.
Yeah. Max Abrams, let me turn back to you about something coming up that we know that's coming up in President Trump's future, and that's North Korea. Or did you want to talk about Israel for a minute?
Yeah,
okay,
I
mean, sure.
I do. I mean, Israel's an important player in all of this. I mean, some people are saying that this doesn't make the U.S. safer, but it makes Israel safer. And I agree with Gary that I don't even believe that. It's true that U.S. or Israeli intelligence officials, they're very much divided. They're not, you know, at all 100% behind Netanyahu. Many of them think that the deal is a good thing. And furthermore, in the short term, in the short and medium term, let's say, Israel, I think, is definitely less safe. Especially in terms of its northern border, because basically what Israel has been doing is a so-called mow the grass or mow the lawn strategy, where it's been going into Syria and basically attriting Iranian military assets. And thus far, Iran has actually been quite restrained about not, you know, using missiles to attack northern Israel, not unleashing Hezbollah and other, you know, Shiite militia groups. But I think if the Iranian leadership thinks that the Iran deal is going to die, it will blame Israel. And I think that that restraint will go away quite quickly.
Well, I'm seeing here an op-ed from earlier this month in Haaretz noting exactly what you're saying, Max Abrams, that a little earlier this year, an Iranian missile even strayed into Israeli airspace and it was shot down. And so the opinion writer Michael Koplow is saying Donald Trump just put Israel in immediate danger because of the possibility of a full-on Israel-Iran war in Syria. He says it becomes more likely. Gary Samar, what do you make of that?
So the Israelis just revealed today that they had plans, or they have intelligence that the Iranians were putting missiles in the hands of Shia militia in Syria, which were intended to be fired against Israeli military outposts in northern Israel. This is to retaliate for the recent series of raids where Israel has killed some Iranian soldiers in Syria. So I'm afraid that the proxy war or the direct conflict between Israel and Iran is going to heat up in any event. Yeah. I mean, I agree that the collapse of the nuclear deal will be one less constraining factor, but I frankly think even if the nuclear deal was in place, the Iranians were going to retaliate against Israel for killing their soldiers.
Gary Samar, one last question for you, because I do want to just ask. Many people who support the Iran deal have been warning that if President Trump does pull the United States out of it, that one of the major impacts it might have is making the U.S. an unreliable negotiator with North Korea. And so I'm just wondering, this has been done now. Is there truth to that criticism? Is Pyongyang looking at this moment and saying, we're going to, you know, Kim Jong-un's going to sit down at the table with President Trump, but there's going to be no deal?
So, of course, this is, again, you know, reading people's minds. I don't think it matters to Kim Jong-un because he doesn't trust us anyway, whether we're in the deal or not in the deal. So any agreement that the North Koreans negotiate with the United States is not going to actually result in North Korea giving up its nuclear weapons, although they may accept limits. So I don't think it matters. But it does matter with Iran. I mean, if we, having broken the agreement, I think it'd make it much more difficult in the future for Iran to negotiate any kind of an agreement with the U.S. since we have effectively reneged on this agreement.
Max Abrams, got 20 seconds here. Just your thought on North Korea.
The question of credibility is an interesting one. First of all, it's debated in international relations how much it matters. Furthermore, I mean, Trump can say he should have more credibility because essentially what he's doing is executing his campaign pledge to get out of the nuclear deal. On the other hand, it shows that U.S. credibility from one administration to another isn't that good because our foreign policy can dramatically change in the course of a year.
Well, Max Abrams is Assistant Professor of Political Science at Northeastern University. Thank you so very much for joining us today.
My pleasure.
And Gary Seymour, Executive Director for Research at the Belfer Center for Science and International Affairs at the Harvard Kennedy School of Government, and former White House Coordinator for Arms Control and Weapons of Mass Destruction, Proliferation, and Terrorism. He served in that post in the first Obama administration. Gary Seymour, many thanks to you.
Thanks, Meghna. Have a good evening.
We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. New York Attorney General Eric Schneiderman announced yesterday his sudden resignation following allegations that he abused several former romantic partners, including repeatedly slapping and choking them. Schneiderman says he strongly contests the allegations, first published in a blockbuster story in the New Yorker magazine yesterday, but he stepped down almost immediately, saying the allegations would interfere with him, quote, leading the office's work at this critical time. Now, Schneiderman rose to national attention as a major legal foil for President Donald Trump. He's filed over 100 legal and administrative actions against the Trump administration and congressional Republicans, often jointly with other Democratic AGs, including Massachusetts Attorney General Maura Healey. So let's take a look at the impact of Eric Schneiderman's resignation. And joining us to do so is WBUR's legal analyst, Nancy Gertner. She's a retired federal judge and a senior lecturer at Harvard University. Judge Gertner, it's good to see you.
Good to be here.
So this was a blockbuster story with really kind of deeply disturbing allegations about Eric Schneiderman's treatment of women. I just want your first reaction.
Other than agreeing with you, which is remarkable, what's incredible to me is how he thought he could get away with this in these times. How do you think? It was almost as if he thought that because these relationships had been consensual at some point down the line, one could do anything to these women, which was just really extraordinary. So I don't understand how he could even think he could do this and get away with it.
Yeah, I mean, the article, and two of the women came forward on the record with their names, we should note. And it said that.
And one was in 2016.
Yeah, fairly recently, right? They also allege that he was very frequently deeply inebriated as well. One of the women said 5 out of 7 days of the week. And that, you know, again, his statement in response to the New Yorker article, and this is actually what I wanted to ask you about, seemed to suggest that it was consensual.
Well, that's what I was saying before. These clearly were relationships. These were dating relationships, and they were fairly long term. So he had to believe that anything one does to a consensual partner, even if that particular thing is not remotely consented to, is okay. I mean, it really almost harks back to the days when there was such a thing as marital. There was no such thing as marital rape. You know, you're married, and therefore you have permission to do anything. And somehow he thought that the violence here was part of the consent to be in the relationship. Mm. And it's an arcane view of women that I just don't understand how he could possibly have believed it.
Well, and to add to the disturbing nature of this story, the women say that he used his authority, his power as Attorney General of the state of New York, and they say threatened to have them followed, their phones tapped. I mean, one of the women was even quoted as saying, what do you do when the person assaulting you is the top law enforcement official of the state?
I mean, you have to separate out. On the one hand, this is horrific and, you know, and ought to be condemned, and it's not in, and he was right to resign. This is outrageous. There's no question about it. On the other hand, you also have to wonder about the judgment of the man to have done this at this time, given what we have seen? I mean, he's been incredibly out front about his opposition to Trump. And you would imagine that someone who's doing that would be, you know, what is it, purer than Caesar's wife or whatever that is? I mean, he's just the opposite. It makes no sense at all.
Mm. So does this have possibly any effect at all on all of the legal actions that Schneiderman has brought against the Trump administration?
Well, I mean, it eliminates a certain leadership. One can only assume. So the existing cases, there are other attorneys general, notably our own, who are involved in that. One can only assume that the actual day-to-day litigation is being carried out by other people. So existing litigation is one thing. But, you know, there's been a sort of undercurrent in the press that Schneiderman was not cooperating with Mueller, but at least was going to be a backstop to Bob Mueller's investigation, and that if individuals were pardoned, New York law is a little technical, they have to be pardoned by Trump before there's an indictment, then if they're state crimes, it could be followed up with state prosecutions.
Right.
So he was, there was always at least the hope that Trump could not completely wipe out legitimate prosecutions by a pardon under certain circumstances. Who knows where that will go now?
Yeah. I should say that Attorney General Maura Healey did put out a statement about this. She said, "I was deeply troubled to learn of the disturbing allegations made against Eric Schneiderman, supports his decision to resign. Her heart goes out to the women who came forward." Then Healey also wrote, "The women and men who serve in the New York Attorney General's office work every day to enforce the law and protect the rights of all Americans. I look forward to working with the next Attorney General of New York to continue that important work."
Right. I mean, so existing lawsuits, one can only assume, are being done by line officers. Leadership in the future is the open question. He has been incredibly out front in opposing the Trump administration.
Okay, so let's turn to another story that also has a New York link and another former New York prosecutor, this time Rudy Giuliani. It's been a while since I've talked to you about the Stormy Daniels story, but here we go, because there's been a lot going on. As people probably know, Rudy Giuliani joined the president's legal team and said some pretty interesting things. Last week on Sean Hannity's show on Fox, Giuliani insisted that Michael Cohen, the president's former personal attorney, did pay Stormy Daniels with Trump's knowledge, and that those payments were legal.
Having something to do with paying some Stormy Daniels woman, $130,000, I mean, which is going to turn out to be perfectly legal. That money was not campaign money. Sorry, I'm giving you a fact now that you don't know. It's not campaign money.
Stop shaking your head, Judge Gertner, because there's more. So Giuliani says not a campaign finance violation, and then he doubled down to ABC's George Stephanopoulos this weekend.
Number one, it was not a campaign contribution because it would have been done anyway. This is the kind of thing that I've settled for celebrities and famous people. Every lawyer that does that kind of work has. And number two, even if it was considered a campaign contribution, it was entirely reimbursed out of personal funds, which I don't think we'll even get to because the first one's enough.
Now, Judge Gertner, under most circumstances, I'd like to think that I have a fairly decent understanding of things. But what is going on?
What is going on with Giuliani? What is going on in the case? What's going on in the world? You have to be more precise.
All three. No. What is going on with Rudy Giuliani? He dropped these statements and everyone's head turned, and I can't tell what's true and what's not anymore.
Well, the facts, the things that he said, which directly contradict things that the president said. So that's one box. A lawyer should not do that, full stop. The argument that even if these facts, as he alleged them to be, were true, that somehow this isn't a campaign violation, is also not something a lawyer should say, because it is either, yes, it was a campaign violation, or at least it is an arguable one for which there will be further investigation and further, who knows, further prosecutions. The best argument I had heard was someone who said this wasn't a campaign contribution. It wasn't a campaign contribution because Trump didn't expect to win at the time, and so he was just protecting his family.
But how can that be if the payments were made during the course of the campaign?
Well, there's that, and this is with respect to a 2012 event. So the timing of this is incredibly suspect. In addition, Giuliani said that it was because the campaign, the timing of the campaign, it was in October. The election was in November. So either he's simply wrong in his legal judgment that this isn't a campaign violation at all, or at least what he's done is present us with facts that make it an arguable campaign violation, which means there'll be another investigation. I mean, it makes no sense. Nothing of this makes sense, either as a strategy for a client or as, dare I say it, the law.
Well, what about a political strategy?
Doesn't make sense in any way, shape, or form. I mean, I think, the John Edwards was prosecuted for something very similar with respect to this, which is to say someone made a contribution to pay off the woman who was bearing his child. It was arguably something that cared about, you might care about the impact on the family, but the timing of it and the circumstances of it mid-campaign made it clear or made it arguable. He was ultimately acquitted, made it arguable that it was a campaign violation. So either Giuliani has now opened the door to making these payments in the zone of campaign payments in the way that the president was trying not to do.
So you're saying that you really cannot think of one justifiable legal strategy to what Giuliani has said in defense of his client, the president?
I can't think of a single one. I mean, the notion, what he was saying, which is really doesn't make any sense, is that because Cohen was on a retainer, which meant he had a certain amount of money every month, and this is what he did for Trump, that somehow this took it out of the campaign violation world. And actually, it doesn't. So it doesn't make any sense. Anyone would succeed in proving that it was related to the campaign rather than something else is another question. As I said, John Edwards was ultimately acquitted.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that's a different issue.
It had huge political consequences
for
Edwards,
huge political
which apparently it has none so far for President Trump politically. I want to play one more piece of tape here. I mean, it's to a point you were making. Again, here's Giuliani on ABC's George Stephanopoulos saying that these payments would have been made even if there had been no campaign.
This was for another purpose, to protect him, to protect his family. It may have involved the campaign. Doesn't matter. And it would have been done under any other circumstances if there was no campaign.
If that's the case, then why wasn't it?
And I can prove that it has been done on numerous times, not necessarily with President Trump, but with many other people that I and other lawyers have represented.
Everybody's doing it, apparently.
Right. But think about I want to do a jury, a summary argument to a jury. Ladies and gentlemen of the jury, the government will say, the notion that they would pay off a porn star for a 5-year-old accusation 2 weeks before the election makes no sense as out of a concern for the family. If there was any concern for the family, perhaps he shouldn't have engaged in the underlying conduct when Melania was pregnant. But I mean, yes, there would be everyone does it, and I've been paying off porn stars for the longest time, regardless of the election. But think about whether that makes any sense as a defense.
Okay, so you got yourself into this. Since you just play acted the role of the government's closing, how would the president's defense team close?
Well,
then?
The closing was exactly what
Giuliani was
said.
Saying.
Poor Mrs. Trump. This was in order to protect her from this horrible publicity. I suppose that is arguable, but the timing of it makes no sense. The timing of it is much more related to the campaign.
Okay, and you're undermining the argument right now in the course of describing it. Wow. I'm just glad that A, I never became a lawyer, and B, was never across the courtroom from you, because I would have lost that case for sure. Okay. Let's move away from the chaos upon chaos in Washington and turn briefly, if we could, to Vermont, because there was a very interesting case there that I wanted to talk with you about. It has to do with an 18-year-old former student at a Vermont high school, and he had been arrested in February after he was accused of plotting a school shooting. Didn't do anything. I mean, didn't actually go to school and shoot. But his neighbors and friends had reported to police that he talked about his admiration of the Parkland shooter, even written about shooting plans of his own, and also purchased a gun. So in Vermont, the student was charged with aggravated assault and 2 counts of attempted aggravated murder. Okay, but Vermont Supreme Court ruled that the charges did not match the crime and dropped the most serious ones against him and released him on bail this week. What do you make of the fact that these charges were even put on this young man. He hadn't done anything which I think is ostensibly a crime, had
right?
He?
I think that first this was a bail argument, and part of the bail argument they had to, the defense took the position that he shouldn't be held because this was not a crime. What he did, even as the government described, it was not a crime under Vermont law. The law is always in the unenviable position of not being, well, not, I shouldn't put it this way. I mean, we cannot take action against an individual as a crime unless they have actually done something. We don't criminalize bad intent, bad
speech.
There's
no pre-crime department.
That's right. That's right. There's no pre-crime, like Minority Report. You have to be essentially walking down the road towards the commission of the crime in order for it to be an attempt. And in fact, Vermont had a more strict rule than most, which is that preparation, even elaborate preparation, doesn't comprise walking down that road to the ultimate crime. This is also complicated by, as I understand it, the preparation, which were the things he said, and the purchase of the gun was legal.
Right.
So this is a lawful preparation, which, sort of animated by an illegal intent. But there is no such crime.
I mean, it was really interesting, right? Because they charged him with two counts of attempted aggravated murder and one count of attempted first-degree murders. I mean, these are serious felonies.
Right, right. And I think that what you have is that law enforcement quite appropriately wants to, you know, he's chided after each of these school shootings for not having done more to prevent it. And so here they had someone on their radar screen and they wanted to prevent it. The problem is that you really can't grab someone before they've committed a crime.
And so what do you do? I mean,
well, you monitor, you watch, you talk to, you intervene. You just can't haul them off to jail. But you can do all of those things. There's nothing wrong with watching him. There's nothing wrong with maybe even taking, I don't know what the law is on this, but whether or not one could take steps against the gun, that is to say, take the gun away from him. There are all sorts of things you can do short of attempted murder prosecution. There's now talk in the opinion about wanting to have the legislature amend the law. It's very interesting. Not at all clear how one would amend the law in this situation, since the underlying preparation here, which was speech and purchase of a gun, were lawful.
Okay, so I'm going to go out on a limb here. Do we have something of a double standard with this issue of intent when it comes to the difference between the way this Vermont Supreme Court viewed this case of this 18-year-old versus how we view terrorism? Because I think, aren't the standards for intent in terrorism charges a little bit lower? Like, you don't actually have—correct me. Please help me here. You don't actually have to have committed an act of terrorism to be charged in federal court with an intent-related terrorism charge.
Well, no. I mean, you have to have taken steps.
But didn't he take steps?
But the step he took was lawful. So, for example, there was a case, United States versus Mahana, which was someone who was went to Syria, I believe, to look for a terrorist camp. Couldn't find it. Came home and continued his school. But he was on a blackboard that was talking about dating women, but also talking about terrorism.
So the travel
and the
to
travel
Syria,
was the was argument it? That that's what did it. But in terrorism case, it is in fact the same thing. There has to be some steps along the way. Otherwise, we would be criminalizing speech.
Wow. Well, Nancy Gertner is a retired federal judge, WBUR's senior legal analyst, and a senior lecturer at Harvard Law School. Thank you so very much, Judge Gertner. It's always a pleasure.
You're very welcome.
We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Bill and Melinda Gates, Michael Bloomberg, Richard Branson. You've heard of them. They're all billionaires who've signed what's called the Giving Pledge, a group of ultra-wealthy business people who've committed to dedicating the majority of their wealth to philanthropy. But have you heard of Bill Cummings? He, too, has signed the Giving Pledge, and if the name does ring a bell, it's because maybe you've seen Cummings Park in Woburn, Cummings Center in Beverly. The 81-year-old is the founder of Cummings Properties, the huge Massachusetts real estate firm whose assets are now put towards the philanthropy of the Cummings Foundation. But before you think that Bill Cummings is something of a Bay State version of Bill Gates, you know, the billionaire philanthropist who's got an outsized influence on public policy by virtue of his money, well, think again. Because, in fact, the Cummings Foundation operates very differently from the Gates Foundation. Cummings has a grant-making process where community members decide what services they need the most. And we're going to hear more about that in a minute. But first, you've got to get to know Bill Cummings a little bit better. He tells his story in his new book, Starting Small and Making It Big.
I grew up in Medford, a very modest background. I had one sister. We lived with our parents and a one-bedroom apartment up over a liquor store and a laundromat on Salem Street in Medford, and had a very happy childhood. There was always plenty of food. It was very modest, though.
Yeah.
My mom, what her job was in the days that I remember her doing it, was going around for the March of Dimes with the little paper can, going around the street door-to-door, donations for the Cancer Society or whatever it might be. The Red Cross was another big one. And she would do them all. And she was a stay-at-home mom. And my mother took that very seriously. And that was sort of my model. Stayed in Medford most of my life. I went to high school, went to college at Tufts, graduated from Tufts University in 1958. A long way back, I know. I took successive jobs with two national sales company. One of them I was peddling Vicks VapoRub. The other I was with Gorton's, the fish stick people. So
yeah.
One smelly product to another.
But I read, that you, what were you, 12 when you first kind of had a notion that you wanted to go into business or you were interested in business?
I was pretty serious about it by the time I was 12. I was peddling things off around the neighborhood before that and was encouraged by my parents. This was not too long after the Great Depression,
mm-hmm.
remember?
Mm-hmm.
And that was the prevailing thinking of most people who got through the Depression and were happy to see another side coming, but they couldn't shed all that they had learned in the last 15 years before that.
And so is that part of where your entrepreneurial spirit came from, or was there also something in addition to that maybe sort of fundamental about business that you really liked?
More happenstance as far as that goes. I was on a city commercial block. There weren't any other kids on the block. And I did other things.
Yeah.
Those weren't the days when there were programs around that I knew anything about, of Little League or soccer or Pee Wee football or any of the things that my kids all took a part of. They just weren't there at that time. Or if they were, we didn't know anything about it. There weren't very many of them. And I did other things, and I got into business and loved it.
Wow. Oh, that's really interesting. All of a sudden, it's making me wonder if we're over-programming kids and ought to just sort of let them roam around and maybe more might find that entrepreneurial spirit.
I've wondered exactly that.
Yeah.
I think it's probably does happen in many cases.
Wow. Now, you met your wife because of fruit punch?
My dad happened to know about a very small company on Fulton Street in Medford that was for sale, and it had been around for more than 100 years as making old Medford fruit punch. The company was all but out of business. They had one part-time worker, and he made fruit punch on Wednesday afternoon. I bought the business for $4,000 after several hours of discussion back and forth with the seller, and we concluded the whole deal in one afternoon, though.
Wow.
The next morning, I had the keys to the business and was in the fruit punch business.
And you met your wife through this?
Yeah. I met my wife at the Mass Eye and Ear Infirmary. Joyce was a hospital dietitian there. This was her first full-time job, and we met in the kitchen.
You were selling juice to them?
I was selling fruit punch and providing a dispenser put it on the cafeteria line. And that was the secret to the business. We provide electric refrigerated dispensers. Primarily, we were in colleges and universities, though,
mm-hmm.
almost exclusively.
I see.
By the end, we had 330 or 40 college accounts.
Wow.
Yeah. And we're selling a lot of fruit punch. I operated it for 6 years, I think, altogether. I bought it for $4,000, as I mentioned, and sold it for $970,000 or something like that.
In 6 years?
In 6 years. And, of course, those were $1,968, $1,969. And those started me off in the real estate business.
Honestly, you really never know where your seed money is going to come from. Bill Cummings obviously loved hard work and had an eye for opportunity. He had a pretty simple rule: buy land that had development potential. Cummings is also very much a real estate man of the old school. He told me he personally guaranteed every loan he took, and he also doesn't like leverage. Today, Cummings properties are debt-free. That's $1 billion worth of property, 11 million square feet, now making money entirely for philanthropy.
11 million square feet, and every bit of it is in Massachusetts. Most of it today is owned by Cummings Foundation.
Mm-hmm.
And that my wife and I decided a long time ago that we had more than we needed or wanted, and our kids were completely supportive in that thought, and they didn't want to be in the business, but neither did they want us just to sell it to somebody for profit, and they were totally supportive of our plans together to build Cummings Foundation.
Tell me a little bit more about the conversation that you and your wife had that led you to create the foundation, because it's a big decision to make, right? I mean, you have this giant portfolio, $1 billion worth of assets that you want to put to work somewhere. What made you go down the road of philanthropy?
We formed Cummings Foundation in 1986, but in 86 we weren't doing anything much with it. We formed it as a place to begin to build an endowment. And over a period of time, that began to grow fairly substantial. We had always, since I've first been in business, I think there's a strong obligation for anyone that's in business in a community to support the activities that are formed in that community to help the people who live there. And by and large, those are going to include employees of the business, aren't they? And to support the local economy on not-for-profits is something we always did. It was 10% of all of our profits from day one. So the foundation was easy. So eventually we started putting substantial amounts into the foundation. We started putting buildings in, and that was the approach we took. And so now the majority of the buildings are already owned by the foundation, and the rest of them are all pledged to it. When we're not here anymore, that they'll pass to the foundation.
And you said your kids were okay with that because they didn't really have that much interest in the business?
I had previously provided them with what we felt they needed, and turned out there was more than they needed, and all four of them have given back substantial amounts.
I see. Okay.
Themselves to the foundation.
Okay.
The foundation, it depends vitally on local volunteers. We gave, in the course of this year, probably $15 million that were distributed solely at the discretion of community volunteers.
So this is what I really wanted to share with you, because Cummings is so understated about it. So let me repeat what he just said. Bill Cummings' billion-dollar foundation distributes money at the discretion of community volunteers. The foundation reaches out to communities. They recruit teachers, firefighters, other volunteers, you know, experienced grant writers too, and has them decide over several rounds which nonprofits in their community will get the grants. So Cummings says this kind of community-based philanthropic decision-making is pretty easy to justify. I mean, who knows better what a community needs than the community itself? Now contrast this to the Gates Foundation, let's say, a powerful philanthropy that's done great work, certainly, but also reaps a lot of criticism for its outsized policy influence in certain sectors. I'm thinking of, say, Gates' education reform efforts. So I asked Bill Cummings about that, about whether Gates deserves such criticism.
If it was self-serving in some way for him, it wouldn't be the right kind of influence. But when it's being done by most of the people who have these funds, most of the people at least who are in the giving pledge, most of them didn't inherit their money. Mm-hmm. Many did, but most did not. And certainly the Gateses didn't.
Yeah.
And if they know as much as they do and are willing to put their funds out there and for no gain whatsoever, I find it, you know, pretty sad that they do come under as much criticism as you point out, and I know they do on occasion. So that happens. Boston Foundation is a very similar size to Cummings Foundation locally, and it has a wonderful program of, on a small way, doing what Gates does.
Yeah,
we're different in the sense we don't try to directly influence anything, and I don't criticize. I think Boston Foundation does wonderful things. But it's altogether different.
Yeah.
And we're not better because we don't do it. We're trying to come up with something that's altogether new, though, in having the community get a big hand in how it's done. They make the decisions, and 95% of the money we give is to organizations that my wife Joyce and I never heard of before.
Yeah. But this is a really, really critical difference, though. Like you said, it's something new. I don't think that many foundations use this means by which to decide who to disperse the funds to.
Oh, I think you're absolutely right. Yeah. They don't. What we're working toward is just this new kind of a foundation in the end that is really a community foundation right down to the actual giving.
When you put the decision-making in the hands of community members, it's easy for me to see how the positives to that, right? Because like you say, it goes through this process, and so the best applicants rise to the top. But the whole time, it's like the community is saying, here's what we really feel we need the most. So that makes a lot of sense to me. But at the same time, it's taking the decision power away, more or less, from the foundation itself. And I think there's a lot of boards of foundations that would feel really uncomfortable with that. I mean, what would you say to them?
We've got a pretty potent board, a pretty effective board. It's got three college presidents, justice of the Mass Supreme Court, former major newspaper president, and you know, physicians and others that are like the volunteers. And all of those people, by the way, have been among the volunteers, working with the volunteers side by side. They're there. They know so much more about the community, and we've got all these people, and they will hunker down and really get in and visit the organizations that are applying for the funds. And how else could we do it?
Yeah.
How could we reach out to all these small organizations if we had to hire a staff? Cummings Foundation, how many employees? One paid employee. And that's Joel Swetz, who's been our executive director for 14 years, I guess, something like that. Joel is an attorney by training, a probate attorney, I guess. Does a wonderful job in orchestrating the legalities of everything that we do to make sure we do it the right way as far as administration is concerned. He never gets involved in grant making at all.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think he's ever sat in on a grant discussion. I don't get involved in them, and Joyce doesn't. We try to encourage the volunteers.
Yeah.
Make them realize how important they are.
Well, so I guess my last question is just a real easy one. It's in the book, yes, but also do you have a piece of advice for young aspiring entrepreneurs now?
I think the most usable advice I would give aspiring entrepreneurs is to don't even think about doing that unless they're ready to go in it and really dedicate themselves to it and recognize that it doesn't mean I'm working for myself. Nobody's going to give me any more hard time and tell me what to do when I'm working because I'll work for myself. And that kind of an approach is a recipe for disaster. If they're going to have a business, they're going to start something, it has to be something that's got the full dedication and they've got to go to bed thinking it and wake up in the morning because they've got something they're dying to get done that day.
Yeah. Wow. So what do you, you've done so much. What are the things that you wake up thinking you're dying to get done?
You gave me the perfect chance to talk about the book again now.
That's what I won't.
But I won't.
Okay. Well, I'll just wrap up that in that case, because we've been going for so long. Bill Cummings is founder of Cummings Properties and the Cummings Foundation, and he's also author of Starting Small and Making It Big, An Entrepreneur's Journey to Billion-Dollar Philanthropist. Bill Cummings, it's been an incredible pleasure to speak with you. Thank you so very much.
I've certainly enjoyed the opportunity, and thank you so much, Magda.
Radio Boston is produced by Jamie Bologna, Chris Siderick, and Paris Alston. We had help today from Zoe Mitchell, Susie Tapson, and Lily Tyson. Tim Skoog is our technical director. Our executive producer is Hitesh Hathi. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.